Hello and welcome to this week's instalment of Nucleus Investment Insights. This week our focus returns to the novel coronavirus as the situation matures and governments around the world have now had time to digest and act on this potentially global epidemic. At present there have been nearly 25,000 confirmed cases with nearly 500 casualties around the world, and the World Health Organization has declared the outbreak a public health emergency of international concern. In a similar vein to the SARS epidemic, the prospect for intense market volatility is high as passenger movements between countries have been restricted and global supply chains are brought into question. The bright side is that this level of uncertainty means that markets have the potential to overreact, providing opportunity for those well prepared. Here to discuss how to invest in a pandemic is our own chief strategist, David Llewellyn-Smith. G'day, David.
G'day, Tim.
And our head of investments, Damien Klassen. Hello, Damien.
Hi, Tim.
Fantastic. And just a quick reminder before we get started to subscribe on YouTube. We're notified when we go live and also when there's a new webinar to watch, and to follow us on your preferred podcast platform. And for those listening in live now, feel free to drop in a question in the chat box below along the way. So the agenda today, so we're going to have a look at the stats so far. We'll then roll into a SARS comparison. We'll then have a look at some economic trade-offs. A view will then turn to the local shores in the Australian impact of both tourism, students, commodities, the RBA and the AUD or the Aussie dollar. And then finally, we'll wrap up, as always, with the investment implications and where we think there's going to be some impacts and also where there are some opportunities. So, gentlemen, to start us off, stats so far.
Yeah, look, I thought it was worth running through quickly just where we're at, because I think that one of the key things we're highlighting is that we know that the stats from Wuhan or the Hubei province are all not quite right. So I just wanted to highlight some of the key bits so that when we're trying to look at the stats about what's happening, we tend to break that off and put those to one side and then look at what's happening in the rest of China, and then also look at what's happening in the rest of the world with the idea that we just think there's been so much underreporting, and some of it might be that the systems, you know, some of it might not be malicious. It might just be that they didn't have the knowledge of it, or they didn't have the testing equipment, or that people were presenting as sick, but they literally could not. If it was only a mild version, they literally just did not have the capacity to find out whether they actually did have the coronavirus or not, because there's so many. So when we look at it from this perspective, there's been about 40 times more deaths in the Hubei province than what you've seen elsewhere in China. So significantly greater, obviously, the key point where it all started. But then if you flick to the next slide, there's actually only about twice as many, a little bit more than twice as many cases in Hubei as what you're seeing in the rest of China. And 2 weeks ago, they actually said, oh, look, it was roughly about the same number of cases. I guess what we're looking at is that the data, as you go further back from Hubei, is just garbage.
Dropping away.
And so chances are the levels are much, much higher. Maybe some of it is because of local governments hiding the information in early stages. Maybe it's not. Maybe it is just incompetence rather than malicious.
Right.
But or constrained.
Could we like just extrapolate that chart to say there are 40 times many cases in Hubei, do you think?
I think you could say at least there's 20 times more cases. Yeah. It could easily be 40 times. Yeah. I think that's, it's clearly though.
So that'd be 800K.
You've got a number of people out there saying if it's 40 more, it'd be 800. I'm saying 20 more is more likely. Which would put you at 400K. So I think somewhere above 200, I think, is quite likely.
Mm.
And I think there's a lot of other virologists and people who are more expert than me at doing the maths who are suggesting 300 plus. So it's endemic in that region. Now the question is, can you stop the spread to the rest of the world? Or the first question is, can you stop the spread to the rest of China? And so far, that doesn't look like it is happening, because these cases are coming up across, you know, a range of different cities. You aren't having the same number of people die, though, a much, much lower rate. The World Health Organization thinks that some of that is just because the hospitals in Wuhan are overrun. And so you get to the point where you've only got a certain number of, say, ventilators to help these people breathe. You're much better off if you've got this disease being in a city that where you've got your own bed and your own ventilator and all that type of stuff, rather than in a city where there's already, you know, 1,000 or 2,000 people using all the possible ventilators and you just don't have access to it. And
yeah,
so,
that's a good point.
So that might be behind it. But I guess the main thing in terms of the stats I want to impress is that you know, the older stats you're seeing, and when you look at some of the hockey stick graphs, they are because some of that earlier stuff is depressed.
Yep.
And so it probably is a bit slower. Like, the stats probably aren't as bad as what you'd get if you just extrapolate this hockey stick graph you know, up dramatically.
Yep.
But they're still pretty bad. So, if you flick to the next one, we then say the rest of the world. The rest of the world cases just keep ticking up every day. Having said that, though, very few of them so far are actually genuine cases that were transferred in those countries. They usually are somebody caught the disease in China and then traveled to one of these countries, and then they've been been picked up.
Yep.
But having said that, there are there's a growing number of cases out there that are genuine, you know, second order or third order passing on. But at the moment, you'd say, you certainly couldn't definitively make the case that this disease has spread to the rest of the world and that it'll pass on. It does look that it's spread to the rest of China.
Yep.
from that Hubei province, and it's going to be very, very hard to contain it within China. Most of the virologists tend to think that, no, this will get out to the rest of the world. It's a matter about just slowing it down so that you don't have so many people packing your hospitals. You don't want 1,000 people all sick at the same time. If you can have 100 a week for 10 weeks, is far better than 1,000 all in 1 week, because you can actually deal with it and more people will survive. But you know, the rest of the world, really, we don't know what's going on, and we won't know for another couple of weeks whether you're going to see a broad spread to the rest of the world, because the data we're seeing really is just travelers as opposed to... Yeah, actually starting to see it take off in other countries.
Yep, okay. And they, I saw this morning there was 12 reported cases in Australia as well, which was...
13,
is it? Yeah, okay. Yeah. Which, you know, against the broad 25,000 globally is quite small, so it shows there's some containment here that seems to be working.
Well, no, there's only 200 and something. We're up there in the league table, so to speak.
Fifth, I think.
Yeah. Yep. So there's a couple of countries, Japan in particular, that's got a lot of cases. Not a lot of cases, you know, 30 odd cases, and a bit of person to person spreading within that country.
Is that counting that ship that they've bailed
up?
Yeah,
that's counting that ship.
Okay. Yep. Sure.
And then you're looking at a whole raft of other countries that have sort of somewhere between 5 and 15 cases where travelers have gone to, and they're generally countries that are quite close.
Mm-hmm.
Or bigger countries like the US.
Yep. Yeah. Okay. Sure.
So the mortality rate is basically, you know, how many people are dying from this, and this is the part where trying to get a feel for it is a little bit difficult, because you can't just take how many people are dead right now versus how many cases there are, because the person you just diagnosed today or yesterday hasn't had a chance to die yet. They may very well die. So you sort of, if you've on the top, you've got the deaths, and on the bottom, you've got the mortality rates. If you're including all these people who have just been diagnosed on the bottom, then you're going to get a false reading. It's going to look like it's lower than what it really is.
Sure. Yep.
It takes about 12 days for some, sorry, 14 days for somebody to die once they get the disease.
Right.
On is the median number, but it's really wide. It can be as few as 6 days. Oh, sorry, once they start showing symptoms.
Yep.
It can be as few as 6 days or as many as 40-something days. So you don't really know with this. We've done an analysis just on that we've got showing on screen, where we've just said, well, what happens if we just take the current number of deaths and look back 4 days to see how many people, or if we go back 8 days, or if we go back 12 days,
mm-hmm.
With the view that when people first get the symptoms, they won't be diagnosed as a case yet. Take a couple of days until that happens. And if you do that data, if you do it that way, you see that sort of in the rest of China, you get these mortality rates that are somewhere between 1% and 3%. It's probably likely,
mm-hmm.
if you do it that way. You get similar data with the rest of the world, but there's only two other deaths, so it's not really
reliable
at the moment.
Yep, sure.
If you do this type of analysis in Hubei, you get you know, on a 12-day basis, you get like 75% death rates. And if you go back, you know, there's actually more people. There's more people that are dead today than what Hubei said had the disease 2 weeks ago.
Yeah, sure.
So the chances are that the stats are wrong. So so I guess what we're, so in terms of these, I guess what I'm saying is we just sweep that data away and say, look, something's happening. They'll probably catch up, but there'd probably be maybe some of it's just, you know, that they know they've put out the wrong numbers and they're just going to gradually leak out the right numbers now and eventually get come up the right number. But yeah, you can't trust those numbers, so we just need to separate that out.
Yep. Okay.
So in comparison though, so I guess the key things to know about this is it is quite deadly. So let's say it's 1%. That's about 100 times more deadly than the common flu.
Mm-hmm.
It's 50 times more deadly than the swine flu. It is less deadly than SARS or MER and a lot less deadly than those ones.
Yep.
But it's far more, it's spreading far quicker. So what it makes, what it's lacking in the number of people, in the percentage of people it's killing is it's making up in the, how fast it's spreading.
The spread rate. Yep.
Yeah.
Sure.
So, so that's roughly where we're sitting with the stats so far. So it looks certainly bad, from that perspective. But then let's jump. I might pass over to David for a quick recap of what happened in SARS and economically, because in the end, there's this trade-off we'll talk about later. If we put all the quarantines in place right now, you could be really, really strict. You could kill the global economy and really slow the spread of this disease down, or you could do nothing and have the economy, you know, possibly ticking along until it doesn't. And so it's this trade-off about what's happening there. So we'll talk about what happened during SARS and how big the shutdowns were and what the effects were economically.
Yeah, sure. Handing over to Dave.
So SARS was considerably smaller, obviously, a little under 800 deaths and 8,000 cases, and you know clearly that was smashed much earlier than the Chinese let on in Hubei. And you know, transmission is obviously much more virulent in this new outbreak. We've got, you know, some UBS charts up on the screen for people who can't see them, but basically they show that, you know, China's growth over the one quarter it took to contain SARS, you know, cratered from 12% to 3.5%. But then it rebounded very, very swiftly, and over the year it lost about 1.5% of GDP, which, you know, in the end was really immaterial. However, you know, obviously this is a much more severe outbreak, and the measures being taken by China are also much more severe and draconian than they ever were during SARS as a result. For instance, there were no city blockades or shutdowns during SARS. And we now have, you know, 60 million people under quarantine and any number of other cities and numbers of people who are, you know, being contained in one form or another as well, just not as an official kind of blockade. You know, whether
didn't have other countries banning flights from those?
I don't know if we got that far.
No, I don't.
We had that screening, the heat screening they were doing. Yeah.
The issue with SARS is it didn't transmit prior to
showing up.
Symptoms, prior to showing up. Yeah. So, yeah, it was much easier to pick up.
So, you know, people are roughly guesstimating that something like 70% of the Chinese economy is presently shut down to contain this. You know, what shutdown actually means is difficult to know. It's certainly inhibited in some way. Almost three quarters of the economy is severely inhibited.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is the working model that everyone's using, is that SARS, this will be contained quickly, and the SARS, you know, snapback will be happening by Q2. excuse me, which strikes me, given the severity of the outbreak, the severity of the containment measures, the fact that it's still run out of control and is not contained at all at this point, seemingly, means that this SARS model, as a model for what kind of economic fallout there's going to be, is horribly dated and is not going to work. The impact on Chinese economic activity is already much more severe than it was in SARS. We can see that already in some, you know, very sensitive sort of leading indicators like oil demand,
mm-hmm.
which, is down 25%, and which is roughly 3 million barrels a day. It's like 3% of global demand.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's happened in the matter of 2 weeks.
The other thing is, like, we've got up here transport, hotel and catering as being some of the bigger places that were hit.
Yeah,
I mean, they're much bigger as a percentage of the society now.
They are, absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, there's going to be fallout across the entire Chinese economy. You know, there's basically real estate sales have come to a complete standstill. They're down 80%.
Mm. Stock market?
Well, the stock market's okay. I mean, you know, the Chinese are throwing a lot of liquidity at markets. But, you know, the bond market's been bid to heaven.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, at this point, you know, markets are taking an incredibly kind of Panglossian view on this, using the SARS working model for the kind of fallout. Westpac put out an economic model of the fallout just an hour or so today, and they're still using the SARS kind of implications.
Wow.
to measure what it will do economically, and it's just blown straight past that by a considerable margin, and is getting worse by the day.
Plus, we had it when SARS was there. You know, it was at the tail end of we're already in a economic downturn.
That's right.
It was just sort of reaching the bottom of that economic downturn, and we were just about to launch into and US was already launching into the biggest housing boom, you know, it's seen in whatever 50-100 years, plus European housing boom, plus, you know, all this other debt, corporate debt we'll get onto later, but yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, so
a totally different environment.
So I mean, the SARS, we used the SARS model 2 weeks ago.
Mm.
And even then it was starting to look a little
shaky
in terms of being able to measure the the economic fallout. But at this point in time, I think it's next to useless.
Yep.
You know, it's obviously far more severe than SARS. And, you know, when we look at those virus statistics in terms of transmission, number of cases, new cases and what have you, there's some signs in there that containment might be working a little,
mm-hmm.
in terms of, you know, the spread through wider China.
But we just don't know.
But we just don't know at this point. And Hubei clearly, you know, just completely out of control. And so, you know, each day that goes past is, you know, what's China's GDP these days? 14, 15 trillion US, you know, quarter of that.
Yep.
Is
get rubbed out pretty comfortably.
It appears to be in the process of being rubbed out. Yep. And if it takes an extra quarter, you're up to $7 or $8 trillion.
In 2003 as well, remember that was, you know, they joined the WTO in 2001-ish, 2001. So you didn't have, like, everyone had their supply chains there. There wasn't, you know, there's certainly a few people with a few factories there, but you just didn't have people where their whole supply chain was based on it.
Mm.
We've already had some car manufacturers coming out and just saying, well, we can't produce because all our stuff's coming out of China and it's all shut down.
And everyone's sitting at home.
And so, you know, there was never... You know, and we've spoken a lot about this whole supply chain having to come out of China for political reasons.
Mm.
This is just one huge whack in the face for anyone who was thinking, well, maybe I should be thinking about what am I doing. All of a sudden, your whole supply chain shut down because you were based in one city or one region or whatever, which was fantastic because everything was there. But not only is it a government that doesn't have the same, democratic outlooks and freedom outlooks as yours, but also... You know, you've run into this issue of...
So that's a longer-term implication, definitely, where, you know, the process of deglobalization that began with the trade war will be intensified because of this.
Mm.
But for the time being, we're just talking about a direct blow. It's a demand shock,
yep.
You know, for the entire global economy.
Absolutely.
And so Chinese imports...
And a supply shock as well.
Well, and a supply shock. I mean, it's a comprehensive shock that's unfolding. And... You know, for it to not be a problem, the case numbers are going to have to plateau really fast from here and start falling.
And countries are going to have to take off their bans.
Yes.
Quickly.
Yes.
So if you wanted to get, even if everything plateaued and deaths came off and everything was fine for, you know, for the next 3 months, if countries don't lift their bans and they don't lift their quarantines on those regions, then... I've still got the economic gap.
I mean, I was talking to someone in Shanghai a couple of days ago who just said they're basically they're not allowed to go to work.
Streets are empty.
They're still working from home, but there's been a CCP kind of official posted on their building.
Yeah, right.
No, you're only allowed out for relatively minor things. If anyone in your building gets sick, you're not allowed out at all.
Wow.
And the CCP will deliver food. And so this is Shanghai, which is apparently only got 200-300 cases of it. And so either you have to extrapolate from that that there are a lot more cases, or the shutdown is so completely comprehensive that it's going to have immense economic fallout.
Just a quick one from an avid listener. So what's your time frame, do you think, for the coronavirus to actually be, you know, earmarked as eradicated from I guess China and therefore the world in a way? And this is, I guess, it leads on to another part of the question, which is if you were going to, as Australians for example, if you were going to lift your curtain up and start allowing people in, how much certainty would you need from the Chinese that you're not just going to start this thing all over again in, you know, Q4 2020?
Well, the Lancet modelling, which had some pretty realistic conclusions about the actual number of cases extrapolated from deaths and the global spread, basically said that they thought the epidemic would peak in April in Hubei, and then in broader China, several weeks to a month later.
Mm.
So you're talking about if it is out of control, you're talking about a shutdown through May. And that just gives you the peak. I mean, that might be a point at which markets can start to bid, but it's not the point at which the travel bans come off. If it gets that far, then you'll have a lot of sick people in China, and it could be, you know, another 3 months before the travel bans even come off, which would take you through into Q3.
Yep.
Which is kind of the modelling that Victor Xi did as well, that we had exclusive access to, that, you know, in effect, this is a 6 to 9 month project.
Yep.
To eliminate the virus.
Okay, yeah, all right.
And I think, so there's obviously lots of people working on cures and things like that, but, you know, the reality is if you come up with a cure today, you've got months of testing and
absolutely
all this stuff before you're at the stage where you can actually say, yes, we can roll this out. And we can
vaccines aren't going to work for China, basically.
Mm,
you know, if you're looking at a peak in the epidemic around April, May, you know, the best case would be getting a vaccine around then. So it might work for the rest of the world.
Yep.
But it's too the cat's too out of the bag in China to be effective.
And we don't have a SARS vaccine.
That's so, right.
And that happened
16
years ago. So, yeah.
Yep. No, fair point. Okay. Yeah. Very good. Moving on, UBS reporting.
We went through that, didn't we?
Just happy with that, with the property sector. Okay, so moving into economics, the trade-off. Yeah,
so there's a couple of things on the economics I just wonder, and I've sort of foreshadowed some of this as well, but I think there's this part where you say, we put on quarantines and lock down cities and do the flight bans and it saves more lives, but the more you do of that, the greater the economic effect. And my take was at the start, it was more about, you know, making sure the economic effect wasn't too big. And that was sort of the key focus for most countries and China. And now, I think that's flipped now. And it's gone, okay, no, we've got to save lives. And as you said, it doesn't. The economic impact is just a secondary order and you're just going to have to take it. And so, Australia is a good example in terms of we've just turned around to our largest trading partner, our biggest supplier of tourism and all these other factors, and said, okay, no flights from you.
Yep.
I think there's obviously a political flip, and so that means the economic effect is going to be much larger, and obviously the flow on from that.
It's the same in China. Xi Jinping was actually quite invisible through the early part of the year, and he only kind of reappeared a week ago and declared war on the virus, and we ended up, obviously with these rippling shutdowns and what have you, and the rhetoric coming from the CCP is very clear that first order of business is to stomp on the virus now.
Yeah. Now, and the next step, though, is that following the tracking the number of deaths and cases isn't the same as tracking the economic input. So you could there could be this massive economic crackdown, or not economic, but you know, social crackdown of quarantining people, and you know, this huge effect, which would help, would save more lives, or at least slow the virus down, probably save more lives,
yeah,
and make an effect. But you'd actually see fewer deaths, and so but the economic impact would be bigger. Vice versa, you could see them, you know, lighten up on this, and the economy be a little bit better, but you'd actually see a lot more deaths, but a better economy. So the question about trying to track deaths to say, well, there's been this many more people died, so therefore the economic effect is going to be bigger. We're not really. I mean, we're still talking about, you know, tens or hundreds of thousands of people dying in bad cases, which is not dramatic for a world economy of 7 billion people.
Yep.
Just the effect of those people dying isn't enough to bring the world into recession.
Yep.
But shutting down China for 6 months is certainly enough to bring the world into recession.
Yep. Okay.
And so I guess what we're trying to say is it's not a direct correlation. In some ways it is. You know, the more deaths we see out there, then the more quarantines and everything like that you'll get.
Yep.
But you know, you can't just look at one number and make an assumption that okay, deaths have started to tail off, or cases have started to tail off, therefore everything's fine.
Economics will rebound immediately.
Yeah. Yep.
There's one other point to make, I think, which is very basic, but I think it's important. And most of the modelling I've seen incorporates a lot of stimulus in China as an offset.
Yep.
But how do you stimulate when 70% of the economy is shut down?
I mean,
what are you stimulating?
How do you build more when your builders are sitting at home in lockdown?
Exactly. So until you contain the virus, you can't stimulate jack.
Interesting. All right, very good. We've got a chart up here on some economic cycles. We've got corporate debt.
Yeah, so this is just a US corporate debt to GDP. And just showing, so basically corporate debt's a pretty good indicator of where you are in the cycle and you go into these recessions. So I've got a chart up there back to sort of into the 80s and showing a couple of recessions and pretty much that the corporate debt peaks and you have this recession and then it goes it goes rushing down after that as you get bankruptcies and all these other factors and credit GDP growth slows and people stop lending to companies, and then you start the whole cycle again, and that sort of helps drive the corporate cycle. So in SARS, you know, we were most of the way down the other end of that corporate cycle peak, and you were just about to start into what was a very, very steep uplift for corporates. And what's missing from this graph is how steep the consumer was as well for that. So you know, not a bad time. If you're going to have a crisis, that's the type of time you'd like to have a crisis. And just showing that that's very, very different to where we are now. Now we're sitting at record highs in terms of corporate debt to GDP and the consumer as well. Not the consumer isn't as indebted in the US, but certainly in Australia and lots of other countries. And the consumer in the US is still very indebted, not as high as they were just before the financial crisis, but they still are very indebted. Central banks have all reduced interest rates to pretty much zero, so we're pretty much out of conventional monetary
ammunition.
Conventional. So you need they're going to need to do something different. It just comes down to saying if you're going to pick a time, we've been talking for a long time about we're in the cycle, we're late in the cycle, we don't know what's going to cause the end of the cycle. We posited the question, could this be the thing that causes the end of the cycle? And the answer was absolutely, it could be.
Yep.
That our confidence whether this could be the thing that ends the cycle is increasing as every day passes.
Yeah, sure. So, okay.
So I'll just sort of flesh out the lines of contagion for how that might work. So the US is relatively quarantined from China, like directly.
Economically.
From fallout, direct fallout. It doesn't have huge exports to China. But, you know, unlike places like Europe, which are very dependent on Chinese demand, the US isn't. And it also has a very strong housing market at the moment. So, you know, some of its data points right now are very good. And the Fed cuts of last year have actually given it a new lease on life for this mini cycle. The problem is there are lines of contagion, and you know, probably the main one is the stock market. Obviously, so far it's ignored what's transpired, but if we do get a 6-month shutdown in China, it's really going to crunch the multinational profits growth. Mm-hmm. In fact, it's going to shrink a lot.
And there already are a number of companies talking about supply chain issues.
Yep,
that will be arising.
Starting to seize up. Yep.
And so, you know, if multinational EPS starts to fall materially, then you'll see the stock market get hit, and that'll bring in the US consumer. And there is one other kind of line of contagion, and that's oil. I actually think oil's got further downside, and you know, that'll hit the US oil patch quite hard, and that generally involves, you know, a junk debt shakeout in the US, because it's the main sort of port of call for funding for the oil patch in the shalers.
Yep.
And so that gives you some debt stress as well.
But it doesn't have to be those as well. I mean, there's plenty of companies that are very leveraged and will just turn around and say, well,
they'll just blow up.
My supply chain stuffed. I've got all this debt to pay. I can't actually get any goods because everything's stopped from China.
Yep.
Sorry, I'm going bankrupt.
Yep. Yep.
And once that happens, and you get enough, you know, you need obviously a bit of a quorum of those, but then all of a sudden the everyone in those corporate debt markets who's been lending to anything with a pulse will turn around and say, oh, well, maybe I should be a little bit more, you know.
Take a bit off the table, start a sell.
Yeah, a little bit more just discerning about who I give my loans to, and all of a sudden these people who were expecting to roll their loans over can't roll their loans over, and they start going broke, and you know, then the rates go, and that's a typical credit cycle.
Credit crunch,
I guess what we might be saying there is that the US is more exposed to the supply shock coming out of China potentially, whereas the rest of the world is exposed to the Chinese demand shock. Europe definitely in a big way. Same with all emerging markets. They all rely very heavily on Chinese demand.
Yep.
And that obviously includes us. Australia.
Not officially an emerging market, but we act like one often. Yeah,
well, one in spirit.
Yeah. Okay, very good. And then we'll jump into the wall of worry.
Yeah, it's probably a little bit... look, I just wanted to put this up. There's always something to worry about in markets, and there's always you can always come up with a bad story about what can go wrong.
Yep.
And we see a lot of investors who are sort of frozen in cash for years and years and years, and particularly the last few years about, you know, Donald Trump was voted in. I thought it was the end of the world. I've put all my money into cash, and you've missed this, you know, this
enormous run.
Run up. And so I guess what I wanted to highlight is that, look, stock markets do go up. In general, and usually this wall of worry, they say a stock market climbs this wall of worry. There's all these worries out there, but the stock market keeps going up anyway.
Okay.
And that's certainly been true of the virus to date, is that the stock market in particular has just kept going up. It doesn't mean that every now and again, it doesn't mean it never happens.
Yep.
And the reality is every now and again, you do have the wall of worry was right. Yep. And, you know, it's every sort of 5 to 10 years, and you get these big shocks. And in those, the drawdowns from stock markets can be massive, and it can take years and years and years to ever get that money back.
Mm.
And I think in the US, they sort of went through two or three of these cycles where they made all this money in 2000. And then if you had a board at the top of 2000, by 2007, you would have just been getting your money back just as the next one hit.
Yeah,
and right. Now you're just getting your money. You're a little bit in front of where you were. But the issue is, yes, stock markets do keep going up in time, and if you're just dripping money in all the time, and you know, it's you're not trying to play these cycles, and you just want to you're happy to take these big drawdowns when they happen.
Mm.
But for us, we do think this is big enough and enough of an issue, and certainly stock markets are extended in their valuations. If stock markets were at the moment we're talking. The price of a stock compared to the earnings of a stock is about almost 20 times. It's about 19 times higher,
yep.
Which is high for a stock market. They usually average around sort of more like 14 or 15.
Yep.
If we're talking about 10 times, we might be saying, well, you know, we're ready to buy it, buying the dips.
Yep.
But sure. When you've got a stock market that's already expensive, and if it fell 20%, it would still be expensive.
Yep.
And with earnings, with growth, with worries about earnings, so that bottom of the,
yep,
you know, your price on top of your earnings, if your earnings falls 20%, well, then your price has to fall 20% just for the market to stay expensive.
Stay where it is. Yeah.
And usually what happens when that happens is, you know, the earnings falls 20%, the market falls 20% to match the earnings. And then the market says, just a minute, what am I doing being expensive just to buy falling earnings? And then it
really goes.
Really goes. Yep. So, yeah, so that's where, I guess, despite the fact that markets do generally go up, you know, for us, this is a part about saying, we want to take some safety, take a lot off the table,
yep,
and sort of really try and look for safety at this point, with the idea that, you know, if and when markets fall, that's when we need that ammunition to go in and pick up stocks generally.
Yeah, the war chest. Yeah. Mm. Okay. Very good. Still on the wall of worry. Moving on. The Australian fallout.
Yeah. Well.
Here we go.
Yeah, well, in the short term, the immediate fallout, we're probably, you know, already seeing reported on the press that with the travel bans and what have you, tourism's going to get crunched and the students aren't going to come. You know, pick a number on what kind of hit that could be in Q1. You know, the students are, you know, $12 billion input into the economy.
And have the ability to move into things like real estate.
Of course.
Talking earlier today about, you know, yep, units and, you know, apartment rentals. Could absolutely be, you know, this could be the trigger point for...
Well, you've already got a construction bust.
That's right.
Underway. We've got excess, massive excess supply in Sydney and Melbourne in apartments.
And now we've got a demand shock.
Market, and now we'll have a demand shock.
Yeah.
So I'm just waiting for Harry Triguboff to come out and demand some kind of stimulus.
Yep.
So they're the immediate impacts. And, I you know, there's retail as well. I think the tourism student / migration bid will also take a bit of a hit in retail. And then longer term and probably the bigger hit, I think, is commodity prices. You know, we're already seeing, as we've discussed, oil's getting crunched. It's down 10%, 15%, 20% already. That's a big blow to LNG exports, although we've discussed before that might actually be stimulatory to Australia.
Yeah, just a quick version for people is that despite Australia being a huge exporter, almost the world's biggest, or the world's biggest, depending upon which day we got, we take so little in tax revenue from them. And because we've actually let our price be determined by world markets, what it means is that Australia—it's actually, despite being the world's biggest exporter—it is a net negative for most Australians when the price of oil goes up or the price of LNG goes up.
Yeah,
we've been through power predominantly, through power prices. Yeah.
And LNG is looking like it's in an awful lot of trouble. Like the Japan Korea market is already at record lows.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of discussion about imminent force majeure on contract deliveries into China, which is going to flood the market with additional cargoes for as long as it transpires.
What David means there is China's reached a stage where it's now legally, it can say, yes, we've got a contract, but something has happened outside that we couldn't have... anticipated, and so now we're breaking that contract.
Yeah,
and so the issue
not that the Chinese need that excuse generally; they're pretty good anyway. Yeah, doing what they want. Period.
We found very much in the financial crisis that there was a lot of contracts that got torn up because they were just up to pay.
Yeah, sure.
But now I guess
there's an external event that you can
point to, and it does also mean that anyone who has got a contract they didn't really like anymore. Can very easily tear that contract up.
Force majeure and move on.
So the coals have actually rallied a little for reasons that I don't really understand.
Yep.
I think that they're in the gun as well. To some extent, it's because there's a coke shortage in China because so many of the production plants are shut.
Mm, okay.
But I can't see why that would make my life easier for coking coal, given it's the number one input to coke. So I expect those to get hit. And I think the big one really is iron ore. You know, a two-quarter shutdown in China for iron ore will be pretty catastrophic. You know, it's a huge demand shock that will offset last year's supply shock, which is currently normalising.
Mm-hmm.
And so it gets you, you know, basically it gets you through the last or the tail end of Vale's crimped volumes,
mm-hmm.
And smashes the price through the first half of the year. you know, you can pick a price. It's difficult to put it on it when you don't really know which scenario is going to play out. But by mid-year, you've got the, you know, more Vale volumes coming back, plus all the Australian producers are putting out more volumes than last year. They were disrupted by weather and various other factors.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, this really ends the supply shock iron ore boom that we've really supported Australia a lot over the last 18 months, well, year to 18 months, especially the budget. And so that gets you, you know, into a position where, you know, the federal government's facing a quite nasty blow to revenues, just as domestic demand is taking a hit on all sorts of fronts,
mm-hmm.
You know, through services, exposure to China. And yes, they'll certainly allow their fiscal surplus to slide, but, you know, you're going to have the budget just bleeding red ink, you know, through that period. And, you know, they may be forced to stimulate, but they're going to do it only half-heartedly if, you know, if the, you know, worth, you know, if their reputation is worth anything, basically. That's what...
Well, so, yeah, it's an interesting question, isn't it? Because at the moment, they've been very much reluctant to do anything to
yeah.
It's all been about the surplus, and can't go into debt. And how terrible, you know, Labor was throwing all this money at the issues. You would think
a
savvy political operator would be more than happy.
They're not Keynesian,
but they don't seem to.
They're not Keynesian managers.
Yeah,
in coalitions. They will stimulate definitely, and Treasury would see it that way. But I think the coalition will, you know, opt for the kind of things that it's already used. It'd look to bring forward tax cuts, et cetera, and stuff.
First time buyer grants.
Yeah, well, they've more or less got those in the market now.
Yeah.
And so I can't, I definitely can't see a rerun of the kind of fiscal spending that we saw in the GFC from Labor. I think that's very unlikely. And I just simply don't think that they'll do enough.
Yep.
So that obviously puts the heat back on the RBA. They clearly do not want to cut, but then they haven't wanted to cut for 7 years. You know,
over how many cuts?
All the way through, they have resisted cuts, and so that's no change whatsoever for me. I think they've been forced to cut nonstop, and
they haven't got any cuts left anyway. Really,
they don't. No, there'll be almost no mortgage relief. None. It's probably more important that they just get them out of the way so they can get to QE. Because, you know, if you get the two-quarter shock out of China, then there'll be QE coming out of every corner of the earth. And we're going to need it to...
Keep the dollar low,
yeah. I mean, the falling commodity prices will do some of the work, but you don't want to get yourself in a position where those yield spreads start to close, and so the commodity falling commodity price impacts on the dollar offset by, you know, the yield spread closing between Australia and other places, and so you'd start having money come in.
Yep.
And so, you know, RBA, I think, will be forced to act again. Yeah.
Yep. And Aussie dollar down.
Down. Yeah. I mean,
again, no other way.
Again, pick a number.
Yep.
I mean, if coronavirus gets out globally, then anything's possible. I picked 50 cents earlier in the week. You know, but that's the worst case scenario. Some of the more mid case scenarios, though, I think are sub 60.
Yep.
You know, a two quarter shutdown in China is definitely sub 60.
Yep.
I think, you know, because you are in a potential end of cycle shock scenario at that point. So,
interesting.
You'll get panic selling in the areas you would expect, the risk areas of the global economy and global markets.
Yep.
And that's the issue that, like, we've spent a long time debating, is saying, well, you know, you've got these two scenarios where one of them's the virus gets out and the whole world has to start quarantines and shutdowns and all that type of factors. And then the second one is, well, no, what happens if it's just contained to China? I think it's pretty safe to say it's not contained in Wuhan now, and it's highly unlikely it's going to be contained in the rest of China.
Yep.
So I guess what we're basing that analysis on is saying, well, if it does go to the rest of China and you have these shutdowns for 6 months, but doesn't escape to the rest of the world, then that's what all the effects are.
Yep.
If you get to the rest of the world, then all those effects just increase.
And this sort of goes back in a way to that earlier question, where if China can't show to have contained this in a very rapid, potential state, then the rest of the world's just not going to let its residents move into any part of their country, aren't they? And so is that going to reflect well on the CCP? You're just effectively shutting in the whole country until you can solve it.
You know, there is obviously a risk case that China succeeds as well.
Absolutely.
Like the containment.
Upside risk case.
Risk case. Like, given our base case is that it more or less becomes a Chinese pandemic, if it doesn't get into the rest of the world.
But it's still going to be solved
There is a chance that they do manage to contain the thing. I mean, they are doing some pretty extraordinary stuff to succeed. But, you know, it's...
But that relies on a shutdown. And that's that catch-22.
That's baked in.
You have an extreme, as you said, everyone is confined to their own building. Nobody can go. So you're fine if you're a knowledge worker, but a lot of China isn't. A lot of China is manufacturing. If you can't go outside and you can't do all these...
Make widgets.
And then... the economic effect drives the rest of the economy, the rest of the world into recession and via that debt.
The numbers of infections are so big now. I mean, they have to get that done in the next couple of weeks, or those economic effects will mushroom at an explosive rate.
Yep. All right, very good. So we'll roll across to investment implications. So, Damien spent some long hours over the weekend doing all the calcs. What have you got for us?
Yeah, so this is more just coming back to saying, this is less about that. This is just saying, last time we spoke, so 2 weeks ago, we said, okay, here's what we think would happen. Bonds will get bid, the Aussie dollar down, commodities down, and stocks down. So the first three of those are all sort of moving generally in the right direction.
Mm-hmm.
The stocks...
toyed with it.
That's right. They've had a day or two here and there, but really it's gone the other way.
It's been a strong reporting season too, hasn't it, for some of the big tech guys that seem to drive a bit of the market. Is that having some sort of implication?
Yeah, maybe. Earnings in aggregate really haven't moved very far.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not like... So there's certainly been a number of companies, individual companies, where you say that was a great reporting season from them, a few of the tech ones.
Big ones.
But in aggregate across all companies... we're not seeing upgrades to 2020 or 2021 numbers.
Also, if you look at the value of those big techs that have had the stellar earnings, their valuation versus the rest of the market is at an all-time relative extreme.
Yep.
You know, like they've really been driving the value uplift.
Yep, sure. Yep, that's a good point.
Yeah. So with that in mind... what are we doing about it? So we've gone pretty defensive, and we were already defensive to start with, and I shouldn't say pretty defensive, I should say very defensive. So Aussie equities, we're at our minimum weights across all our portfolios. We're underweight international equities in most portfolios. We're overweight bonds, cash. We've sort of largely factored in, moving that into some foreign currencies to pick up currency gains as the Aussie dollar falls. So, for the large part, we're not as defensive as you could ever get, but we're not very far off it.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
All
and
right.
So the question for us is saying, maybe there's a blow-off to come. Maybe there's a bit more excitement. Maybe the market will be a bit like the Trump trade deal. It'll keep trading off the whole. Maybe there's a cure coming. We need to bid the market up.
Yeah.
Don't know. But I think given the risk-reward scenario at the moment, more than happy to sit out, whatever blow-off the stock market has at the moment to say, well, the negative cases are certainly severe enough and seem to be likely enough at this point in the cycle that there's no sense being a hero trying to chase a 2, 3, 4, 5% final blow-off of the stock market.
Yep.
I think discretion is going to be the better part of valor at this point.
Well said.
So, happy to underperform a little bit if markets go up because to me it's all about, conserving capital at this point of the cycle.
Mm. Yep, absolutely. Well put. And just final question that's just popped in the chat line there is looking forward now, just looking locally, are you expecting a negative number for Q4 Oz GDP, so Australian Gross Domestic Product? Do you think there's a chance of a negative print for the fourth quarter, given all that we've spoken about?
No, none of this is in the fourth quarter. This is all first quarter.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yep. So, if
not particularly.
Yeah. If we get a fourth quarter print, it'll be our own fault. It won't be.
Yeah. For sure.
Won't be.
For maybe the fourth quarter. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So
I mean, we had retail volumes this morning, and they were okay. Like retail sales were terrible, but in terms of price, but volumes weren't too bad. Yep. So that'll give a bit of a consumption uplift to Q4. I think it'll probably be okay. You know, you've still got NDIS rolling out, what have you. I don't think it'll be stellar by any means, but it'll probably be okay.
Yep. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. See, the keep in mind that GDP is a pretty lagged measure. Mm. So, you know, we're talking.
Yeah, very. It's also just an absolute crapshoot.
Yeah. Yep. Okay.
So many moving parts. Mm. You know, you think everything's weak, and then along come inventories or some other marginal, you know, kind of move, and suddenly it's all good, or the reverse.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Sure. Mm. Well, great answer. I think very good. All right. Thanks, gentlemen, and we'll finish up there on a big show on a huge topic. And coming up next week, we've tentatively booked in our chief resident economist, Leith Van Onselen, of course, who's coming in, and he may be bringing in our property, I can say a resident property expert, but friend of the blog in Catherine Cashmore as well, as a bit of an look into the state of the Melbourne property market going forward. So we'll look forward to that next week.
Well, that's it for now, and thanks for watching. If you like what you heard today and you'd like to hear more, head over to nucleuswealth.com/subscribe. Give us your email address, and in return, we'll send you a weekly email with new webinar topics, links for our podcasts, and other news from Nucleus Wealth. I certainly hope you've got something out of today, as I have, and we'll look forward to catching you at the next one. Cheers.